The shutdown is over for now. Today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump and congressional leaders strike a deal to reopen the government for 3 weeks. There's no funding for the wall, but the president is not giving up on that.
No border security plan can ever work without a physical barrier. Just doesn't happen.
Also, longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone is indicted on charges relating to WikiLeaks and efforts to sway the 2016 election.
Stone was covering up, and he's been busted in a stone cold, if you will, way on this.
Stone even wrote an email in which he discusses doing a Frank Pantangeli. Fans of The Godfather will understand that reference. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We begin today with big news out of Washington. President Trump and congressional leaders have reached a deal to end the government shutdown for now. It's a shutdown, as you know, that's forced some 800,000 federal workers to go without pay for the past 35 days. Republicans and Democrats now have 3 weeks to come up with an agreement on border security. Otherwise, the government could shut down again.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
Vox congressional reporter Ella Nilsen joins us from Washington. What is in this deal, Ella?
So what's in this deal is it's money to reopen the government and specifically the shuttered federal agencies for 3 weeks. So this is going to get employees back to work and get them back pay for the paychecks that they've lost out on. But there's no wall money in this deal. That's probably the most important thing to highlight. That was the thing that President Trump said was his signature ask. It was the thing. It was basically why the government hasn't reopened until now. So he's still not getting that in this deal. That's a big thing to note.
But you did say the deal includes retroactive payments and salaries. Is that for all furloughed employees or just some?
No, that so far as we know, it's for all furloughed employees.
Are Republicans and Democrats essentially just kicking the can down the road? Like, what happens 3 weeks from now if they don't have a deal?
I mean, this, like President Trump said, the same thing. I mean, I think that Republicans and Democrats, you know, sort of seeing how long this shutdown went for and how much pain came to federal employees, financial pain, are going to work really hard to try to make sure this doesn't happen again. But, you know, I've been talking to some House Democrats that are still pretty adamant in their opposition to money for Trump's border wall. They were supposed to release their own proposal today, kind of a sort of counteroffer of sorts, basically a statement on what they are willing to negotiate on when it comes to border security. And I had heard that that did not include money for a border wall. And of course, you know, even though Trump kind of capitulated on this today, he was still very insistent in his speech this afternoon that he wants wall funding.
Yeah, so will this be seen as Trump caving to Democrats, and how will this announcement play to his base?
You know, I think that it will sort of be seen as the president caving. I mean, he did not get what he wanted in this, and his base does not get what it wants, namely the border wall. I mean, it's obviously the president has seen his, you know, he might have been sort of calculating that popular opinion counts for maybe more than his base. I mean, his numbers in polls have been slipping in the past few weeks as numbers of his Democratic opponents like Nancy Pelosi have not taken such a hit in public opinion. So perhaps the president is sort of calculating that he is in worse standing with the rest of the country. But certainly among his hardcore base, I don't think this looks like a win.
So now Congress is going to debate border security. I mean, you're on Capitol Hill right now. What kind of issues and proposals are on the table? What are you hearing?
So besides the wall money, there is, of course, just increased technology at ports of entry and sort of beefing up existing infrastructure. There, I think Democrats and Republicans can both agree on that there need to be more border agents and more personnel. There will likely be funding for more immigration judges, things like, you know, technology to detect people coming over the border. But the big sticking point here, in addition to, you know, whether there will be money for physical barriers, I think another thing to watch is whether the White House is going to try to do any moves to restrict legal immigration programs. We saw some of that in the proposal that Trump had announced this weekend, one of the bills that the Senate voted on yesterday that ultimately failed. There were some pretty significant cuts to some legal immigration programs as well. That's something that the White House has tried to do a number of times, and that would be a huge sticking point for Democrats.
Yeah, like DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood
exactly.
Arrival program. Will that
TPS.
Be on the table?
Yeah, I think DACA and TPS, temporary protected status, are two programs that, you know, Trump may try to, you know, maybe sweeten the deal for Democrats with, but we also need to kind of look and see, you know, there were some changes to eligibility requirements for DACA, for instance, in the president's plan. We're going to have to sort of take a closer look at the details of what he's proposing.
And very briefly, I mean, Trump talked about his wall a lot, but he also alternated with great security, that phrase. Is he preparing for, like, the event that he just doesn't get that wall?
I mean, I think possibly. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, has been pretty adamant in telling Trump no on the border wall. I do think that Democrats have signaled some willingness sort of internally to negotiate on some sort of,
gotcha,
you know,
Ella.
Kind of smaller.
We're
going
to have to
barrier.
Leave it there, Ella. Really appreciate
okay.
your time. Ella Nilsen, a congressional reporter for Vox.
Thank you.
Also today, we woke up this morning to another indictment, another link in the chain that is the Russia investigation, another piece of the puzzle.
Longtime Donald Trump confidant Roger Stone in a federal court in Florida.
Stone being charged with obstruction, 5 counts of giving false statements, as well as witness tampering.
All connected to what he knew about the hacking of Hillary Clinton's emails during the 2016 campaign and what he told the Trump campaign about those leaks.
Stone is the 6th former Trump advisor to be indicted or plead guilty to charges from special counsel Robert Mueller. Here's what Stone said earlier today outside the courthouse in Florida, throwing up peace signs like the iconic photo of his friend Richard Nixon.
I will plead not guilty to these charges. I will defeat them in court. I believe this is a politically motivated investigation.
Today, we want to focus on what this indictment says about the Mueller investigation and possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. The Atlantic's Franklin Foer has been following this closely, as has our own Matthew Bell. Franklin Foer says Roger Stone has known Trump since the 80s and that Stone himself is well known in Washington.
Stone was one of the brightest political consultants of his generation.
Going back to Nixon, right? And the point that he has that tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Right. He admired Richard Nixon for being a dirty trickster. He did dirty tricks on behalf of Richard Nixon. And his brilliance was always tainted by his tendency to enmesh himself in scandal. And so his career has always been stunted because of his sleaziness. And here is just kind of the capstone of that, the time where he finally gets thoroughly busted for it.
There may never be a final Mueller report, but when you look at this indictment, this is the Mueller report, isn't it? And these are Mueller's conclusions getting trotted out before the public.
I'm hesitant to go that far.
Really?
I think what we've seen here is that Mueller's investigation into collusion with WikiLeaks, which is a cutout for the Russians, was something that Roger Stone was desperate to hide, and that he went to great lengths to try to prevent other witnesses from cooperating with the House investigation into this, and that he lied when he was talking to officials. And there's a lot of incredibly suggestive evidence buried in this indictment about communication that existed between Stone and the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. But I don't think that we're at a place right now where we can say anything terribly conclusive, except for the fact that Stone was covering up and that he's been busted in a stone cold, if you will, way on this.
Well, we'll get to some of the other nuances in the indictment, but let's just go over these seven counts. A lot of them are about Stone, as you say, lying under oath at Congress. Did he also lie directly to Mueller?
So the thing that's most striking here is the witness tampering part of it. I mean, he evokes the Godfather, too, in talking to another witness.
It says very clearly in the indictment on multiple occasions, including on or about December 1st, 2017, Stone told Person 2 that Person 2 should do a Frank Pentangeli before Congress.
Mr. Pentangeli, you're contradicting a sworn statement you previously made to me and signed. I ask you again, sir. Here and now, under oath, were you at any time a member of a crime organization headed by Michael Corleone?
I don't know nothing about that. Oh. I was in the olive oil business with his father, but that was a long time ago, that's all.
All right, so there we go. Godfather Part 2.
It's just striking that Roger Stone would place himself in an analogy where he was part of a criminal enterprise that needed to lie before Congress on behalf of whatever the metaphorical olive oil business is.
Right. It seems really consequential, the witness intimidation factor in all of this, because it could mean more jail time for Roger Stone. But Franklin, what did you learn in this indictment about the connections with WikiLeaks, which— remember that Mike Pompeo, now Secretary of State, described WikiLeaks as a hostile intelligence service.
You know, I think the thing to remember about all this is we got to go back and we got to look at the way in which Mueller's indictments against other individuals have unfolded. He doesn't necessarily give away the whole game in an indictment. It seems like he's trying to get somebody to cooperate by indicting them on more procedural charges about obstruction, about lying, in order to get their help with some sort of broader narrative that he's trying to fill in. And so I would be surprised if we know the entirety of everything that Robert Mueller knows through this indictment.
The World's Matthew Bell and I are speaking with The Atlantic's Franklin Foer about the arrest of Trump associate Roger Stone. So Stone is the sixth Trump aide charged in Mueller's investigation and the 34th person overall. Franklin, based on what we know now, is President Trump a Russian asset?
We can't say that. Maybe an unwitting Russian asset, but we can't say that he was a witting Russian asset.
But at this point, how crazy is that question?
It's an entirely appropriate question. I mean, clearly, it seems the entirety of the Mueller investigation is driving at giving us an answer to that question.
Looking ahead, if it does turn out that Trump is or was a Russian asset, is that treason?
There's a legal definition of treason that's incredibly specific. And then there's the way that we use it in the vernacular. And I think it's probably unlikely that we would ever get to the legal definition of treason.
What about, now that we're throwing around big words here, what about impeachment? Is that appropriate to be talking about at this point?
There is a huge amount of pressure on Democrats to proceed ahead with impeachment. And I just don't think that we're there yet when it comes to what we know about Russian involvement in the 2016 campaign. We might well get there, especially with the president's obstruction into that investigation, but we're certainly not there when it comes to his relationship with the Russians.
Are things picking up now? Is that what you're seeing? And what are you going to be looking out for in the coming days and weeks?
There's this question hovering over the Mueller investigation that is extremely difficult for somebody on the outside to answer, which is it picking up or is it wrapping up? And my hunch when I look at the pattern of events is that we're not really at the end stages yet. This indictment was, everybody knew it was coming. Roger Stone said it was inevitable and he was going to get indicted. Months passed by and now it's finally arrived. And it could be that he's got his own sequence for how he needs things to unfold. I think the Cohen stuff is still the much more explosive and significant thing waiting to come down. And I think it's pretty telling that Mueller really does not want Cohen talking about Russia in public. And it seems pretty obvious that that's where the big action's at.
Franklin Foer with The Atlantic, really appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to The World's Matthew Bell. And by the way, Matthew's gone through the 24-page indictment and pulled out the key parts. That's at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Saudi Arabia has attracted a lot of condemnation lately, much of it aimed at the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. The CIA has said it believes he authorized the horrific murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in a Saudi consulate in Turkey last October. The Crown Prince is also behind the ongoing Saudi assault on Yemen, which has created one of the globe's most desperate humanitarian crises. That's what he's been doing outside the kingdom. Inside, he's seen as enacting change, big change. It's all part of his Vision 2030, an ambitious plan to wean the kingdom off its dependence on oil and diversify the Saudi economy. One key part of the plan is entertainment, as in making Saudi Arabia fun. The World's Carol Hills reports.
If you're thinking about a place to have fun, it's probably not Saudi Arabia. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is aware of this, and he's investing $64 billion to change the image of his kingdom. He created the generic-sounding General Entertainment Authority, known as GEA, to organize and plan all the fun. The marching orders, themed attractions, shows and performance arts, culture and arts, nature, digital, sports, and sightseeing.
Saudi Arabia plans to turn dozens of islands in the Red Sea into a sprawling, visa-free luxury resort destination.
That suggests that at least some of this new fun will be geared toward tourists and expats without the constraints of Saudi's deeply conservative society. Women there must cover up in public. Gender segregation is the norm. Alcohol is forbidden. But make no mistake, much of the planned fun is to cheer up Saudis themselves. 60% of them are under 30, and they're really bored.
This is a security initiative in some way.
Karen Young studies the Saudi economy at the American Enterprise Institute. She says it's imperative that Mohammed bin Salman get young Saudis on his side.
You think about the grievances that drove the Arab Spring protest in 2011. A lot of it was about social isolation, especially of young men, of feeling that they followed the rules, they went to school, they graduated, but they couldn't find a job, they couldn't get married, they couldn't have those signals of kind of moving forward in their lives.
For years, fun for many Saudis has meant going elsewhere. In 2018, they spent around $21 billion outside the kingdom, mostly in Dubai. Mohammed bin Salman wants to recapture that money, so he seems to be trying to bring a little bit of Dubai to Saudi Arabia.
The results speak for themselves. The first Comic-Con in Saudi Arabia. The first rap concert. The first jazz festival. And that's only the beginning.
It's a beginning that young Saudis are noticing. I spoke to a 26-year-old woman I'll call Aisha. She doesn't want to use her real name. Aisha lives and works in Saudi Arabia.
I mean, we are happy here now. People are happy. People are satisfied. I do have a lot of Saudi friends that are very happy, and they want more. They're always asking for more, and they were saying, what's yet to come? How can I be freer?
Aisha's from a nearby country and is married to a Saudi man, and she's delighted that there's more to do now. She and her husband went to the kingdom's first ever comedy club recently, and she was surprised by what she heard.
They talked about cultural norms, which was a taboo topic, like how their families treat them, how their families look at this new generation. About women, women's rights was very off topic. I mean, we have never heard that. Finally, women can drive, and, you know, certain jokes about it. It was something we never even dared to talk about.
Popular Western bands are one thing that the new entertainment initiatives are bringing to the kingdom. Last month, the Black Eyed Peas, Enrique Iglesias, and others performed in a music festival near Riyadh. But they'd been under pressure to cancel after the October murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
This notion that Saudi Arabia is opening up, I'm sorry to point out, the fact is it's an illusion.
Nasser Wadadi is an activist with the Human Rights Foundation, which led the campaign to get the Western acts to bow out in protest. Wadadi says these efforts at fun by the Saudi government are all an act.
It's an act to create the illusion that Saudi Arabia all of a sudden is this open and welcoming place. The problem is that it's not an open and welcome place for the natives, the citizens of Saudi Arabia, who are being thrown in jail for the simple act of tweeting something that somebody in the government doesn't like.
Aisha agrees that there's been little to no reform where freedom of speech is concerned.
That's still limited. I mean, you cannot have an opinion where the government does not approve it.
But Aisha finds herself rooting for Mohammed bin Salman's reforms. He's clipped the authority of the religious police. At least in big cities like Riyadh and Jeddah, they're not on the streets scolding women anymore. And in the workplace, in her own workplace, Aisha has seen dramatic change.
Organizations used to have separate places for men and women. Now companies are opening up because they're like, we cannot have women have their own offices and not deal with men only via emails and telephones. You have to see them personally. You have to go and talk to them. You have to go to presentations. This was something that we never saw before.
But some things are taking longer to change. Last summer, a young Saudi woman experimenting with her newfound freedom went to a concert. That's allowed now. She rushed the stage to hug the performer, a popular singer from Iraq. She was pulled off the stage and detained. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
We've got a couple of minutes here, so I just want to share some historic news from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC has never in its history had a change of leaders through an election until this week. Yesterday, before a huge crowd, Felix Tshisekedi was sworn in as the new president of Congo.
Tshisekedi Tshilombo Félix Antoine, élu président de la République démocratique du Congo.
Tshisekedi pledged to unite the nation, and today he promised to release all political prisoners. Behind the scenes, not everything is as smooth as it may seem. Moving out of the presidential palace is Joseph Kabila, whose family has run the country for more than 20 years. Kabila and Tshisekedi have long been rivals, like their fathers before them, but there are allegations that two men cooked up a deal. Muzan Cody, a UK-based political consultant, put it this way.
There are suspicions of arrangements having been made between the outgoing regime and himself for him to be declared the winner of the election. So that's going to be with him for quite some time to come.
The new president, Tshisekedi, and the old one, Kabila, are by no means buddies. But it seems they prefer each other to a third man, anti-corruption campaigner and presidential candidate, Martin Fayulu. International observers say Fayulu actually won the election, but Congo's Supreme Court has denied his request for a recount. So Tshisekedi is in and has been recognized by world powers, including the U.S., but it seems he'll have a hard time delivering on his campaign promises to improve the lives of Congo's people. In fact, it's not clear the new president of the DRC will be able to do much at all. This is how Stephanie Walters at the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa explained it to my colleagues at the BBC.
This outcome is one that allows Kabila to maintain essentially control over all of the key areas, notably the army and the police, as well as the economic sectors in the DRC and the key ministries of defense and foreign affairs. So there is no question that Kabila will continue to be a significant presence in politics in the Congo.
It makes it seem kind of ironic that the country's full name is the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, countries around the globe are choosing sides in Venezuela's battle over who is the rightful president there. The U.S. has thrown its support behind the opposition leader.
This is a logical move given the increasingly dire circumstances within Venezuela.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. No new mass protests in Venezuela today, but Juan Guaido, who was recognized by the U.S. this week as the country's interim president, says more protests are coming. The unrest has many Venezuelans here in the U.S. feeling like they can't go back home. That's why there's a bill in Congress to provide them with temporary protective status, TPS. It was introduced last week by Representatives Darren Soto and Mario Diaz-Balart, both of Florida. I asked Congressman Soto why he thinks the legislation is needed.
Well, we understand, particularly with the advent of the murderous Maduro regime, that political asylum makes sense from a civil rights and refugee point of view. We have over 233,000 Venezuelans in Florida alone, and over 3 million have left the country since Maduro took office. We see freedom of speech has been eliminated. Political opposition has been murdered. People's businesses have been taken. It is one of the worst human rights crises that we have in the Americas. And with the United States being a beacon of freedom and having a long-standing tradition of being a haven for refugees, we felt it was critical. And the bill is bipartisan in the House, as you correctly mentioned. I introduced it with Mario Diaz-Balart, a Republican congressman from South Florida. And in the Senate, Senator Bob Menendez is joined by fellow Floridian Senator Marco Rubio. And we already have other Democrats and Republicans joining to co-sponsor at this point.
Does it make it more likely that this bill will pass and that President Trump will sign it?
Of course, it's absolutely essential for its possibility to be passed that it be bipartisan. We have a Democratic House now. We have a Republican Senate, a Republican president, and frankly, a Republican president who has not been a big fan of TPS. However, we have the Trump administration first levying sanctions on the Maduro regime, and now recognizing the opposition leader, Guaido, as the acting president since under the Constitution, Maduro's election was fraudulent. It goes then to the head of the National Assembly under the Constitution. So this would be consistent with those moves to allow another tool to be used to help bring democracy and freedom back to Venezuela by giving folks temporary protective status here in the United States.
Congressman Soto, you represent a district in Central Florida in the Orlando area. Are there a lot of Venezuelan exiles already there? And if so, what stories are you hearing from them?
Sure. We have over 33,000 estimated Venezuelans. Majority are exiles in Central Florida, over 200,000 in South Florida. So from the Sunshine State, we're talking massive numbers. Not a day goes by where we don't hear from new Venezuelan refugees asking for assistance with political asylum. It is, in fact, inundated my office and other offices of members of Congress, and right now they have to apply individually. This would give an automatic temporary protective status, something we've done before for Haitians, and we saw it in countries in Central America like Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, back after natural disasters, and we've done it for refugee status for places like Sudan. So
And as we mentioned, TPS programs are being ended for other nationalities by the Trump administration. How do you feel about that?
So that is their push. However, as we negotiate the end of this shutdown, I believe that TPS will be part of a grand deal should we get one together. So I don't think the rest of that story is written just yet. Dreamers, TPS are two things that are being discussed, and particularly to give them a eligibility for residency. That'll be something that the U.S. House will be pushing for as we navigate through this.
I mean, those TPS programs need to obviously be renewed if they're to continue. But I mean, do you see some hypocrisy here that some TPS programs are being ended and others are being started?
Well, the program is temporary, so programs will end at some point. But the key is that if folks are here for 10, 15, 20 years, they're integral in the economic and social fabric of our nation. We can make a decision at the end to grant residency. But it isn't hypocritical because these programs are temporary and some will end. Certainly with these longstanding programs, though, I think the right call is residency.
Congressman Darren Soto speaking with us from Washington. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
More than 300 Venezuelans who protested against the government this week were arrested by authorities, and chances are many of them are now inside a prison in Caracas called El Helicoide. It's a futuristic-looking former luxury shopping mall that's now headquarters for the Maduro government's secret police, and there's a history of political prisoners being tortured there. Our BBC colleague Karenina Valandia spoke with both former detainees and former El Helicoide guards to find out more.
In 2014 and 2017, massive anti-government protests rocked Venezuela. The protesters were met by riot police, and hundreds were taken to El Helicoide.
I spent 2 years, 6 months, and 8 days living in perhaps the biggest torture center in Venezuela.
Rosmit Mantilla was a political activist and member of a party opposed to the government of President Maduro. He was arrested during the 2014 protest and accused of helping finance them, a charge he denies.
In May 2014, I don't think there were more than 50 of us detained there, and it was already tight. Within 2 years, the number had increased to 300.
Rosmit says he was held with protesters and regular criminals, packed side by side into improvised cells, often without access to daylight or sanitation.
The size didn't matter. What mattered was the number of people that they could fit in that room. If they could push 100 people inside a room, that room would host 100 people. They added bars and they locked people inside.
Working at the prison during this time were two prison guards who agreed to speak to the BBC. Interviews with those inside the Venezuelan secret police are rare, and we can't reveal their identities because they fear government reprisals against their families. One former guard, whom we are calling Manuel, said the aim was to make people afraid.
And I think they get it, in a way.
His words have been translated.
Because nowadays, when there is a protest or a march, many Venezuelans are scared because they don't want to be arrested.
I've been in regular contact with a number of prisoners who were detained at the Lelicoide. All of them described the systematic use of torture by the security services to obtain confessions. Victor, again not his real name or voice, is another former guard.
They took a transparent bag and they would suffocate the detainee to obtain information by covering their head with a bag. They use small electrical devices on different parts of the inmates' bodies, on the neck, on their feet, their ribs, and even on their genitals.
Manuel also told me that the torture was systematic.
While I was there, it didn't happen around me regularly because I was part of the percentage of officers who didn't agree with the situation. Because we knew that at some point it could have legal implications. And we had to protect ourselves from that.
And you were not involved?
No.
Okay, the reason why I ask is because some detainees have said that you were involved in beatings.
I understand that many detainees will have a version of events. Yes, I know some of them were mistreated. But for you to accuse someone, you need to have proof. So it would be very difficult for someone to name me.
In May last year, prisoners took control of El Helicoide. Security officers regained control shortly after, and many inmates were released or transferred to other jails. But according to former prisoners, around 150 are still detained there. The political activist Rosmit Mantilla was released in 2016 and has been granted asylum in France. Among the estimated 3 million people who have also left the country to seek a better life are the former guards, Victor and Manuel. The BBC asked the Venezuelan authorities for a detailed response to the allegations made in this report. They did not reply.
The BBC's Karenina Valandia reporting there on conditions inside El Helicoide, the former Caracas mall where many of Venezuela's political prisoners have been held. Meanwhile, the Maduro government has ordered U.S. diplomats to leave Venezuela by this weekend. Patrick Duddy was the U.S. ambassador in Caracas from 2007 to 2010. He was thrown out of the country by Maduro's predecessor, President Hugo Chavez. That was in 2007. This time, Duddy says some American diplomats have already left, but not all.
The embassy is staffed. There has been a departure order for non-essential staff and some family members. But, you know, the security and situation in Caracas has long been extraordinarily difficult. According to any number of international organizations, Caracas may well be not only the most dangerous capital city in the world, but arguably, for some people, the most dangerous city in the world. They have an extraordinarily high homicide rate. And in a period of relative instability, such as the present moment, prudence would dictate that embassy staff stay within those neighborhoods in which security is relatively better.
The footage I've seen of the protests and the rioting, you talked about the violence. I mean, the police firing on protesters, people dying. Some of it suggests that without resolution at the political level, this could devolve into something much worse. I mean, Ambassador Dutta, you've represented the U.S. and Venezuela under Bush and Obama. Based on your experiences there, where do you think things are headed?
If, in fact, the EU, the U.S., and the countries of Latin America can plot an exit strategy, then perhaps further violence and suffering can be avoided. But of course,
plot an exit strategy for Maduro?
Yeah, it's no longer tenable for them to hold on to power.
So I know you've been a long time a proponent of Latin America providing regional support and outreach to Venezuela. And now there's this overwhelming support from a lot of Latin American countries for Juan Guaido for interim president. The United States is also on board. The EU is on board. Regardless of how anyone feels about Maduro, this seems like an aggressive move to recognize this other person. How do you see it?
This is not so much an aggressive move as a logical move given the increasingly dire circumstances within Venezuela. Venezuela is increasingly a failing or even failed state. And as the neighborhood, if you will, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, etc., are discovering, the problems of a failed state cannot be contained by the state's borders. About 3 million people have fled Venezuela, and taking care of those refugees is taxing the support services of all of its neighbors and also putting them on notice that if things don't change in Venezuela, it's going to get worse, not only internally, but externally.
So as far as Latin American countries go and supporting Juan Guaido, do you think this is the region just kind of jumping at the opportunity for change in Venezuela?
I think that what's happened in the last week should rather be seen as a logical progression. Imagine, if you will, that you had your savings in the national currency in whatever country, and you were experiencing 1,000,000% inflation.
Yeah, I don't even know how to kind of calculate that, but right.
Right, right. I mean, who does? Millions of Venezuelans have seen their savings and retirement programs completely wiped out. There have been food shortages, shortages of medicine, a surge in criminal violence, drug trafficking through the country, and the very, very lively sense that people in the Chavista regime, in the Maduro administration, have presided over not only incompetent but corrupt management of the country.
So is this a unique and hopeful time for Venezuela?
I think it's a very dangerous time for Venezuela. There are those in the government who insist on their legitimacy, though most of the rest of the world rejects it. There are military elements which have sworn allegiance to the Constitution, but inevitably have ties with the current regime.
With Maduro.
There are those who fear that if they lose power, they go directly to jail. It's not clear just what the pathway is to an assumption of real executive authority by the new interim president. What is clear is that most of the rest of the world believes that the current situation is unsustainable, highly unstable, and that the country needs to return to democracy, restore law and order, and change direction economically. And it's going to need help. It's going to need help.
Patrick Dutty was U.S. ambassador to Venezuela under George W. Bush and again under President Obama. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So much news has been happening this week that some stories have slipped under the radar here, like what's been happening in Southeast Australia. It's been suffering from a brutal heat wave. Yesterday, it hit 120 degrees Fahrenheit near Melbourne.
I walked out of the house this morning to go to the gym at 6 o'clock, and it felt like I had walked into a full-body hairdryer that would not leave me alone.
That's Madeline Morris, a reporter for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Melbourne.
There's funny stories about people doing things like baking cookies in their car and frying eggs on the pavement and that sort of stuff. And you know, that's all good fun. But look, for us, it really is quite serious.
It is serious for Australians, really for the whole planet. But in describing Australia right now, some people have even used the word apocalyptic. Listen to this. Dead horses found near dried-up watering holes. Bats falling out of trees from heat stress. Dead fish piling up in dry river basins. David Littleproud is Australia's Federal Minister for Agriculture and Water Resources.
It's a severe drought, and we have to be honest about that. In Western Queensland and Western New South Wales, we've seen thousands of kangaroos that have died because of the drought. They've starved.
The extreme heat took hold 2 weeks ago and has not let up, breaking records that have stood for decades in some cities. Meanwhile, Australia is coming up on the 10th anniversary of the terrible wildfires that are remembered as Black Saturday. In February 2009, intense heat waves created the conditions for fires that killed 173 people.
We just haven't had the rain. It's dry. There's no water flowing. I mean, we've got to be honest. We can't make it rain. If I could, I would.
In the absence of rain, authorities are asking people to look out for elderly friends and neighbors who might be especially vulnerable to the heat. People have been flocking to the beaches and air-conditioned malls. One hotel in South Australia was offering free beer as long as temperatures stayed above 45 degrees Celsius. Not sure how that helps with staying hydrated, but it's a thought that counts, I suppose. Here's another story that made big headlines this week in West Africa that you may not have heard about: the opening of a bridge in the Gambia. This bridge is just two lanes stretching about a mile across a river, but it's a really big deal for West Africa, the Gambia and Senegal especially.
This imposing bridge now ends centuries of travel difficulties, easy movement of people, and faster delivery of goods and services are now guaranteed around the clock.
Might sound like the classic politician grandstanding there, but Gambian President Adama Barrow has a point here. The opening of this bridge is historic for West Africa. It's called the Senegambia Bridge, and to understand its significance, picture the geography of neighboring Senegal and the Gambia. The Gambia is a really skinny country tucked inside Senegal. It's just 15 to 30 miles wide, some 300 miles long, and sliced down the middle by the Gambia River. To the west, it borders the Atlantic Ocean. The rest of the country is entirely surrounded by Senegal. So here's why the new bridge is a big deal. Until now, there were no roads crossing the Gambia River. None. And most travel from, say, the north of Senegal to the country's south happened one of two ways. You waited for a ferry, sometimes for hours or even days, depending on traffic, or you drove all the way around the Gambia, a 300-mile detour. Truckers transporting perishable goods were the most affected. Cargo sometimes spoiled in transit. So naturally, truckers in the Gambia and Senegal are among the most excited about this new bridge.
I've been using this route for the past 15 years, and today I thank God the hurdles that I've been experiencing over the years have finally come to an end. This is what we've been asking for, easy access. We should commend the leaders of the two countries, and moreover, the bridge will cement the relationship between the two.
This bridge is long overdue. Initially, we encountered lots of challenges, delays, long queues. At times, I would spend 10 to 20 days waiting for the ferry to cross. It didn't only affect drivers, but the businesses. But with this bridge, there is no hindrance.
The Gambia and Senegal negotiated construction of the bridge for decades, and work on it finally began in 2012. Now that the project is complete, everyone's happy, right? Not everyone. Small business owners on either side of the crossing are worried about their future. For them, drivers waiting for hours and days to get on a ferry meant customers. Now they stand to lose business as people speed by on the new bridge.
I have been doing business here since 1986. I sell different items in my shop, and the profit I make is what I use to take care of my family. I'm a father of eight. The bridge has a negative impact on my business. The bridge is a blessing for drivers, but a curse for the businesses.
The fact that vehicles will be using the bridge instead of the ferry has already affected our business. We were told that a market would be built for us so that we would not be out of jobs, but that is yet to come.
Two merchants in the Gambia worried about the impact a new bridge across the Gambia River will have on their livelihood. Two steps forward, a little slide back.
Thank you.
We take you all over the planet on the world. This music alone does that. Here's who's involved in this supergroup project known as Bocante. Michael League with the eclectic New York-based band Snarky Puppy. The Metropole Orkest, a Dutch ensemble that's part big band, part symphony. A bunch of other talented artists from Sweden, Ghana, all made complete by this singer from Guadeloupe, Malika Tirolien. This is the track Maison en Feu, that means house on fire in French. Tout a commencé avec l'éclat d'une étincelle, soudain il fut réel, sa route se trace. Il est le fils de la peur et de sa compagne terreur, à trois il cause des douleurs sans regret. À peine naissant, si fougueux, si gourmand, son baiser incandescent brûle le parquet. Son appétit sans fin, dangereux comme un venin, paralysant les destins sur son trajet. Il ne faut pas traîner, il faut le noyer, il faut l'arrêter, ou tout va brûler. We must hurry, we must stop it, or all will be burned. Hey, it's symbolism, but read into it what you will. Maison en Feu from the new CD by the supergroup Bocante and Metropole Orkest. That's where we leave things today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We'll see you back here next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.